You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
When I first moved to New York City, I knew the big Broadway shows of Phantom, Les Mis, Wicked, and others. And in high school and college, I had performed in classic musicals like Oklahoma, Fiddler on the Roof, and Kiss Me, Kate. But there's so much more to the history of Broadway, and more broadly, the American theater, than just the popular musicals everyone's heard of. And my guest today has been involved with so many new musicals and plays, as well as revivals, both big and small.
I'm Jack Uertel, originally from Stamford, Connecticut. Spent a lot of time in Los Angeles and a lot of time on Broadway. And as a producer, as a writer, as a dramaturg, and as a I don't know what else.
Jack has the kind of knowledge I wish I had about Broadway history, having studied the various journeys of great shows for his book, The Secret Life of the American Musical. But he's also worked with playwrights like August Wilson and Tony Kushner. He's even conceived the long-running Smokey Joe's Cafe and the critically acclaimed After Midnight, and served as dramaturg as well for Hairspray and Dear Evan Hansen. And with his many colleagues over the years, he's learned the fine art of collaboration.
By the time I became a real producer, I had learned one really important lesson, which is that there's no reason for any artist to trust you. So the first job is somehow convince the artist that you have the same vision they have, that you see it through the same lens.
Welcome to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning theater podcast. I'm Patrick Oliver Jones, a New York actor and singer, and each week I talk with fellow artists about personal setbacks and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can donate, subscribe, and find past episodes. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, welcome, Jack. It is so nice to meet you and a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Very, very grateful to be here.
Now, a few years ago, you wrote a book called The Secret Life of the American Musical. What was the main secret or untold story you were hoping to reveal?
Well, you know, after I had been on Broadway for about 20 years as a working for Jampson Theaters as a producer and dramaturg and general creative director, I started teaching at NYU, teaching graduate students who were writing, composing, and lyric writing students who wanted to write for the musical theater. And I realized, what made me want to do it was I realized that although I don't claim to be any genius at this, I had been involved in so many shows that I understood that there actually were patterns in how musicals convey themselves. And I thought, well, it's not about any wisdom I may have. It's just about the fact that I have a lot of information that students don't have yet. I guess that's every teacher's position. That's why you teach. And so I started to teach this class. And it was basically about the secret was that musicals have structure that resembles each other. That doesn't sound like an English sentence, but you know what I mean. that you can trace certain communication skills that musicals have about how they open, how the characters introduce themselves, how, and all the way through to the finale. And not every musical, of course, follows a pattern that's similar to every other musical, but they're recurring a remarkable amount of the time. So that's what I was teaching the students. I was telling them, you can depart from all of this. You can just wander off and write the musical you want to write, but it's good to know even if you want to be a revolutionary, it's good to know what these structures are because they actually can help.
Because then you kind of know what you're diverting from.
Right, exactly. And you know, I used a number of examples of people who in the theater and in the movies had become very, very experimental, but they became very, very experimental after they had mastered, you know, the art of doing it the regular way. So I thought, well, you know, students don't like to hear that really, but because when I was a student, I didn't want to hear it. But that developed into this book, and it's called The Secret Life of the American Musical, in part because it sounds like a title, but also because the secret is simply that there are rules and regulations, so to speak, that operate in a lot of musicals, which you can ignore, but sort of at your peril. And so I structured the book so that it started with what's an opening number and it ended with what's a finale, and it went chapter by chapter through every typical kind of musical theater structure. And while acknowledging that some shows really don't do.
And what is it about specifically, because the title is American Musical, what's specific about the American musical as opposed to musicals in general?
Well, you know, it was originally called The Secret Life of the Broadway Musical, but then I realized that I hadn't written about any English shows at all. And I think when I looked back at it, it was because English musicals, I mean, there are certainly musicals from other parts of the world as well, but on Broadway, they generally speaking are either American or English. British musicals sort of developed partly on their own as out of pantomime tradition and things like that, that are British, and partly as an imitation of American musicals, which kind of got there first. And so I thought, you know what, you might as well just own up to the fact that you're not going to talk about Andrew Lloyd Webber. You're not going to talk about Lionel Bart, and, not out of any disrespect, it just didn't happen that way. So I changed the title.
Well, let's get into story number one. And this is the day you discovered that you were never going to be a professional actor. And so you were 18 years old. You'd been your best actor at your very small high school that you attended. But something happened in your first college production. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it was actually technically my second college production. I was sort of an extra at my first college production. I played one of the minion in a production of The Dybbuk, but all we had to do was bow our heads while somebody else gave a very, very long lecture, you know, story. So that didn't really count. But then I found myself in a play as a freshman in college. And while I was on stage with two other actors in a three-person scene in front of an audience, I thought to myself, I'm the third best actor in this scene. And we're undergraduates at a college. If I'm the third best actor in a scene in an undergraduate college production, I am never going to be a professional actor. I mean, you know, this is obviously a tough business. And I told this story. I told the story to a number of people, but one of the people I told it to when I was working with Jerry Zaks, I don't remember whether it was on Smokey Joe's Cafe or something, because he too had been an actor who became a director. And I told him this story and he said, Obolo, which is a word he uses from time to time, if you were in front of an audience and you were able to think that rather than playing your character, you were never going to be an actor. At that point, I sort of, you know, resigned from the whole thing. But, you know, being an actor I was an actor because when you're young and you go to the theater, all you see are the actors, right? I mean, you may be aware that there are musicians in the pit. But what you don't see are all the other things that there are: producers, directors, prop people, designers. I mean, there's a million ways to be in the theater without being an actor. There are many more ways without being an actor than there are by being an actor. So I was, you know, it was humiliating, but it was only briefly humiliating. And luckily I was still young and in college, so I could figure out something else.
Now, was that just in your own head that you thought that, or did you get some confirmation from the director or others that?
I think I got a lot of notes from the director, like, don't do this, do this. More notes than other people were getting. And I thought, you know, this is really not good. This is just not good. There was always a sort of insecurity about it. You know, in high school, I played King Arthur in a production of Camelot, which I really hated doing. And I didn't much like the show or the role or anything. I mean, I was 16 years old. What did I know? But it was also true in that show. There's a very long monologue at the end of Act One of that show, which I had a miserable time learning. And then every night, we did three performances maybe. every night while I was doing it, I thought, I hate this. I just hate doing this monologue. I don't want to do it. I'm not sure I remember the end of it while I'm in the middle of it. And I want to get out of here. And I don't think anybody who's really going to be a professional actor, I mean, maybe they have those kinds of feelings. It just seemed to me that there was something off in where my skills were going to find themselves, and it wasn't going to be on the stage performing in front of people.
So then how did you maintain your confidence and motivation to stay in the arts, realizing that acting wasn't going to be it?
The first thing I did was depart completely. I mean, when I say it was humiliating, but only for a little while, it was humiliating enough so that I went from the theater to the radio station and became a, I guess you'd say, a disc jockey, and eventually headed up a couple of departments there. I really didn't go back to theater actively until after I left college. But at the radio station, a couple of people and I got together and had an idea to begin. This was in the 70s, actually in the late 60s. So, it was the middle of the folk music boom, and people like Peter, Paul, and Mary were, famous. And we thought we could actually present concerts sponsored by the radio station if we could get permission from the college dean, which we did, to use one of the halls, the theater. And it was a sort of a fanciful idea, but I called up an agent who managed, I forget what the first one was. It may have been James Taylor, who was not yet the huge thing that he became, but he was well-known. And the agent or manager was, enthusiastic about this idea. There were all these small agencies that represented folk artists in those days. So we did it. And it turned out that what happened was I learned how to be a producer from that. I learned what it meant to distribute tickets and to price tickets and to put up advertising and to do all the things that a producer does. And without meaning to, having given up acting and having essentially given up the theater out of humiliation, I learned how to produce. And then when I got out of college, it was a skill that I didn't even really know I had, but I had it. And when the time came, it became useful.
Yeah. Now, whether you're a producer, whether you're an actor, I think no matter what job we're in, we're constantly comparing ourselves to others, just as you did on stage with the two other actors. How do you deal with the pressure of comparing yourself and seeing where you are in relation to others along your career path?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think I always felt like I was going to be a lieutenant and somebody else was going to be the general. I never felt like I wanted to take, or that I had this gumption or the skills or the chutzpah to actually run a theater or be a lead producer. And I was very lucky in that after a stint as a theater critic in Los Angeles, I got hired as the dramaturg at the Mark Taper Forum. And I didn't even know what a dramaturg was. I'm not sure that people at the Mark Taper Forum do either. But it was a job essentially assisting the artistic director, who was Gordon Davidson, who was one of the legends of the founding of the regional theater movement. And so I could comfortably put myself in second place. And I really didn't want the responsibility of being in first place. And I spent much of my entire career in second place. I went to work for Drew Jampson as the creative director, but I wasn't the president. The first time I really was in charge of something was when I became the third artistic director of the Encores program at New York City Center. By then, there had been two, it was in a weird way, even that was second place, because there had been two previous artistic directors who had set the mold for what Encores would do. So I had to step in and do that, but I didn't have to invent it, and I didn't have to, I was the boss of the moment, not the boss of the generating event of Encores. And I've been very comfortable in that role. I've now written two books, and I guess the books are mine. I can't blame anybody for them, and all I can do is take credit for them. Yeah, I have a new one coming out, and we'll see what happens. But Secret Life of the American Musical has been quite successful.
Well, yeah, and looking back at your resume, which you kind of gave us, the different jobs and positions that you've had in New York theater. You've worked alongside some notable names in the industry like August Wilson and Patti LuPone. You've been a part of development of shows. And so, this resume seems pretty typical for a Broadway theater professional of your caliber. But then I looked at one part of your resume, how you began your professional career, and it was playing the National Bottleneck steel guitar behind artists like Bonnie Raitt and the Pointer Sisters. Now, what was this diversion? How did you go there?
Well, I had been, you know, kind of amateur guitar player since my days in high school, because everybody was an amateur guitar player in 1966 in high school. But I was particularly fascinated by early blues music, and Sunhouse played the National steel guitar, which is a resonator guitar. I don't even know how to describe it exactly, but it's a in today's country music, it looks like a dobro guitar with a big round circle in the middle of it instead of a hole. And inside of it is a resonator, which is like a metal speaker cone. And it was invented before the electric guitar to make a lot of noise at parties and picnics and whatever. And it makes a lot of noise and it has a unique sound. And a lot of blues performers in the 20s and 30s used this guitar. And I really wanted one of them. And so I eventually, a friend of mine said, you know, my grandmother has one of those in the attic. So I said, tell your grandmother, I'll buy it from her. And so now I had a resonator. I had this National steel guitar. And I was fascinated by Sunhouse, who was an amazing blues man from the Delta, Mississippi Delta. He was born in 1902, rediscovered in 1964, and was now playing. But as an older man, he was, you know, he was not playing with the ferocity that he once had. I managed to meet, it was rather easy to do, this was all part of the concert business, to meet him and his manager, Dick Waterman, who just passed away. And then simultaneously, I met Bonnie Raitt, who was a freshman at the time in college, and she was a much better guitar player than I was even then, even as a freshman. She also was fascinated by the blues. We had a lot in common musically, and also her father was John Raitt, so I had a lot of musical theater stuff to chat with her about, and a lot of blues stuff to chat with her about. And she wanted to work out some duets because there were some, you know, to those of us who care, famous pre-war blues duets that were recorded in the 20s and 30s. And so we did. And eventually she became Bonnie Raitt. And I didn't. And she asked me to work with her on, I accompanied her on some gigs in clubs. And then she asked me to be on her second album, which I was happy to do. And then Sun was touring England, and Dick Waterman asked me if I would come and be his, you know, accompanist. And Pointer Sisters is a bit of a stretch. Bonnie called me one day and said, I'm a side person on this Pointer Sisters album. They need a slide guitar for this number. And it happened to be a Sunhouse number called John the Revelator. And they were recording in San Francisco. I was living in LA. So it was on a rainy afternoon. I got on a plane, went to San Francisco, and I'm on a Pointer Sisters album. You just never know.
I mean that's so much of the theater world as well. We happen upon things. We word of mouth, you know, a director or producer, whoever calls us up. Like I'm doing a reading of a musical. I don't know anyone in this, but a producer friend of mine said, hey, they need someone. And so now I'm doing a reading. So you just never know where your jobs are going to come from.
That's for sure. And one piece of advice I give to young people, you know, my students in class, and although I don't teach anymore, but when I did, and anyone who sits down and says, you know, what advice would you give? I say, say yes to any job. Just get in the door. You don't know who you'll meet. You don't know when that person will turn out to be, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who also is just getting started, or when that person will be someone who's only in the theater pits for a minute. But just meet people, say yes to the job.
Well, for story number two, there was a particular playwright that you met, Lanford Wilson, and this is when his play Burn This was having its world premiere at the Mark Taper Forum, which you worked at. Now, you and he were having a conversation, but you came to realize that what you were saying isn't the way you talk to a playwright. So what exactly were you talking about, and what did you take away from this conversation?
I was a huge Lanford Wilson fan from his earliest days, whenever the Rhymers of Eldritch was done. And I had admired him enormously. And I had been a critic for 5 or 6 years before I went to work for the Taper. And I had written a very, very favorable review of two plays that were done in rep at the Mark Taper, which were Fifth of July and Tally's Folly. which are related plays. And so Lanford was very enthusiastic about the fact that I loved his work. And he and his directing partner, Marshall Mason, decided to bring Burn This to the Taper, where I was now working as the dramaturg. And I was, you know, the thing about being a critic is you become incredibly arrogant because you never have to face your adversary. You can write whatever you want. They might be furious with you, but they never get to, or very rarely get to confront you and say, you know, I didn't like what you wrote, and here's why you're wrong and I'm right. It just never happens. And the longer you do it, the more arrogant you tend to be because, you know, what you say is God's word. And it's not a very healthy way to be a critic, but I think it's a disease that every critic is subject to. So I thought, oh, well, Lanford wants me to tell him how to write his play, which, of course, is not at all what Lanford Wilson wanted, and not what any playwright should want or does want. So we were sitting in a bar in L.A. downtown, just because it happened to be sort of adjacent to the Mark Taper, going over the script. And I said something about a line in the play that I thought was not good. And he was drinking a margarita at the time, and he lifted up the glass in his hand and held it behind his head, I mean, or at his ear, as if he was going to throw it in my face. And I thought, Jesus, this playwright that I revere is going to throw a drink in my face, or possibly worse, throw the whole glass, at which point, you know, I'll have a broken nose. And then he just held that position for a little while, as if he was thinking of something. And then he put the glass down, and he said, when you're talking to a playwright whose work you care about, use a different word than cliche. And apparently I had used the word cliche in my pretty, like, this line is a cliche. And it was he was very quiet. He was obviously very angry. And the last, you know, if you idolize someone, the last thing you want is for them to be mad at you and be in the same room with them when they're mad at you. And I was really chastened. And I apologized, and we went on for a little while, but it was clear that the conversation was kind of over. Like, once you get to that point, he's not going to listen anymore, and I'm not going to talk for much longer. So I went back home, and it was like learning that you're not going to be a professional actor. It was a great learning experience that was humiliating, and I think that is how you learn, and that is how you grow. And I learned that day how not to talk to a playwright. It took longer to learn how to talk to a playwright, but at least I knew one thing I couldn't say, and by inference, a whole series of things that I couldn't say or shouldn't say. And in the end, unlike being a critic, when you're working on a new play, you're not trying to give an opinion. You're trying to make it better or let the playwright make it. So rendering judgment is not a good idea. The good idea is to say, this part, this moment here actually confuses me. I'm not sure what you mean. Or something like that, which might allow the playwright to clarify something. But that was my first lesson in the difference between being a critic and being an effective aid to an artist.
And as you became a producer, obviously you're not just working beside some of these authors. You're now the one in charge. You're the one making final decisions in some regard. And so how did you learn to then work and collaborate with other artists in more of a producer job?
Well, I think by the time I became a real producer, I had learned one really important lesson, which is that there's no reason for any artist to trust you unless you make the reason. So the first job is to somehow convince the artist that you have the same vision they have. You're not the artist. You're not as good at doing what they do as they are, but you see it through the same lens. So they really believe you're not trying to write the play that you wish they had written. You're trying to help them, or with casting or directing or anything else. You're trying to be helpful in the sense of amplifying what that artist's work wants to be in the first place. And building trust takes a long time. And requires, you know, a certain amount of just socializing, so to speak. I mean, sitting in a room, not necessarily having drinks, but sitting in a room, talking it through and listening to what they say. You know, my first rule became, don't talk if you can listen. But eventually you'll get to the point where you can't listen anymore. And then you're allowed to talk. And that has worked well for me. And I think the hardest parts have been when there's just something that the producer has to make happen that the artist doesn't really want to have happen. And that sometimes, most usually is, I'm sorry, but this work is 20 minutes too long. I'm not going to tell you where to cut it, but I'm a producer. I need to sell tickets. I'm not selling tickets to a 3.5 hour play. Well, in one case, we did sell tickets to a 3.5 hour play. And actually, it was a 7 hour play, but it was in two parts. You can probably guess which one. But, you know, that kind of thing is like, playwrights love their words and directors love their gesture, their directorial gestures and the performances that they get from the actors, and the actors love their monologues. And, you know, sometimes it just gets hard. You have to say, I understand all that, but it's too long. Cy Feuer, who was a great Broadway producer, produced Guys and Dolls, many other things, once said, everything in show business is 20 minutes too long. And I think basically he's right. Pertains to plays today, I've noticed an awful lot of plays that are now one act. We now have a lot of one act plays produced that all say the same thing. Running time of the play is 90 minutes. The running time of the play is 105 minutes. But then no one will say it. No one, because they know no one wants to sit still for 105 minutes. So they lie to you about how long the play is. And also they don't take into account that they don't start until 7 minutes after. So, you know, I'm digressing beyond any reasonable place. But anyway, that's the hard part of producing. I mean, I'm not even talking about the other part of producing, which is managing, promoting, you know, ad meetings, marketing meetings, all that stuff. That's not about the artist. I've tried to be, the reason I was called the creative director at UJAPS, I've tried to leave most of that stuff to other people. I'm not a good fundraiser. You know, other people are much smarter than me about marketing. I tried to be the person who could deal with the artist, because a lot of those people really can't and don't know how and aren't that interested in it. They want the product to be what they want it to be, but how to get there is a circuitous and non-scientific road.
Would you say that interacting and dealing with playwrights is different from the other artists, you know, the directors, the actors and musicians?
Not terribly. I mean, with a play as opposed to a musical, the playwright really is the author of the play, you know, and it's a play. Whether it was August Wilson or David Wong or Tony Kushner or Terrence McNally, they wrote the play. And so the respect that has to be paid to that is different than what you would necessarily say to a director about his work, which is to interpret the play. With a musical, there really is no author. There are generally two or three writers who are either adapting a previously known work, like Pygmalion is the basis of My Fair Lady, or they're writing an original work, but they're collaborating in a way that means there is no one vision to start with. With that, it's easier, in a sense, to get into trying to align the visions, trying to find out what people are not so eager to tell you about what they see as it, or how they feel about their collaborator, or whatever. That's much more of a boxing ring, in a fun way. With a playwright, there's a certain deference that occurs because it is their play, period. And technically, if they're members of the Dramatists Guild, you've signed a contract that says you can't change anything without the playwright's permission. Now, that can sometimes you can say, okay, go to the Dramatists Guild. Sue me. I'm changing it. Doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, when it comes to musicals, I think you're right that the central focus of one playwright is broadened out to a collaborative group of people. You know, however many people are coming with that musical. In fact, I've worked on a musical adaptation of one of Lanford Wilson's plays, Balm and Gilead. It was called Rain Dogs, and we were doing a musicalized, very contemporary pop rock musicalized version of Balm and Gilead. And we actually had Lanford Wilson come to Bay Street Theater. This was out in Long Island. Mm-hmm. And, yep. and he got to kind of basically meet with the cast, was consulting with the creatives during that week and a half that we were there at Bay Street. And it was really fascinating to be with him, to see him, and, you know, the words of encouragement, but also just what Balm and Gilead was all about. So it was really fascinating to just, as you say, just listen. I didn't need to say anything. I didn't need to add anything.
Right. Yeah.
Just listen to what he had to say about his work.
He was very smart about his work and very, he had an interesting habit. When we first worked on Burn This, which was the first time I really met him, I was in awe of him. We were in Saratoga, New York, because we did a workshop before the paper production. He, when you talk to him, he would repeat what you said sometime. And I realized after a while, he was running the language through his head for rhythm and what the poetics of it might be, you know, and he would do it all the time. And sometimes he would just say, you know, there's a line in this play, I need a three syllable word in the middle of it. Just, he really was a poet in a sense. And he would take, you know, suggestions from the Peanut Gallery and then not use any of them, but they would inspire him to think of three syllable word that he really meant. And I just found him an absolutely fascinating guy to be with.
Yeah, it was a really enjoyable and learning experience to have him a part of that production. The three stories shared in this episode are only part of the conversation. Subscribers get early access to the full interviews with guests, not only including these stories, but audition stories as well. Join Why I'll Never Make It and help support this podcast, as well as learn more about the guests and the lessons they've learned. Go to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or find the link in the show notes. And another benefit of being a subscriber, you won't have to listen to any ads either. Well, for story number three, you want to talk about a thrilling yet painful process of writing and launching the musical adaptation of Jack Finney's novel Time and Again. And you say that it sank as soon as it hit the water. Oh, what was it that made this process so difficult?
It didn't sink. It sank twice. Let me put it that way. Because there were two different productions of it that were quite different from each other. One in San Diego and one in New York. My brother, who was a producer, originally read Time and Again, the novel, and thought it would be an interesting musical. And this was in the era when Phantom of the Opera was a fresh, brand new show. And the idea was that Time and Again, which takes place in 1970 and in 1882, is a time travel story about New York. And so the opportunity to do spectacular scenic shifts from one century to another. And Phantom of the Opera had made scenic shifts, you know, the thing, was kind of irresistible. And it's a great story. And I knew nothing about writing a musical, really. I thought I knew everything about it. I knew nothing. So I set out with a friend of mine, a composer named Skip Kennan, very, very talented composer, lyricist. He had written a musical called Herringbone, a one-person musical called Herringbone, and various other things. But this was now an opportunity to write a many-person, big, huge musical. Because I talked such a good game, I guess, because I had been a critic, and because my brother was my brother, they let me write the book to this, adapt the book for it. And, you know, I just went to work and started writing the scenes that were in the novel as scenes in a play. So suddenly we had, you know, 32, 35 scenes in Act One, you know, 28 scenes in Act Two. And I remember years later, a director saying to me, Mike Ockert was the director, and we were working on something else entirely, saying to me, you know, it's a musical. There's 9 scenes in Act One and 6 scenes in Act Two. And he wasn't being literal. He was just saying, that's about how it works out, you know, usually. Now, things have changed a lot since then because scenic shifts and different scenes happening in different places at the same time have become so common. But in a classic musical, that's pretty much the story. So I had, as it turns out, no idea what I was doing. Skip wrote an absolutely lovely score. And we went out to San Diego, and when we put the thing on stage, it became clear that all of these scenes, nothing really happened in all of these scenes. You had to move scenery to get the post office on stage. And the post office scene was about a guy mailing a letter and another guy watching him mail a letter. Well, that's not a scene. It might be a cutaway in a movie, but it's not a scene in a musical. So my amateurishness and my self-assuredness combined cyclically, including Skip's beautiful score. The show opened, the score got lovely reviews. The audiences were bored out of their minds and had no idea what they were looking at. And so we just had that experience. But the idea of doing Time and Again was still kind of burning in everyone's heart. So we did it again in a very rewritten version in a very small theater. But by now, years had gone by. Phantom of the Opera was in its, you know, seventh year or something. Theater and big scenery musicals as an event had kind of come and gone. And we were now in a different era. And so we thought, well, we'll do it small. We'll do it like, you know, one of those little sweet or sour musicals that get done off Broadway, forgetting somehow or other that the whole point of doing it was to do it for a big, you know, scenic splash. So now here we were having completely lost our way, and we did it a second time, which was, I think, probably as a piece of writing marginally better than the first time, but the whole point had sort of disappeared. And I think this is something that can happen with musicals that almost all musicals take so long to develop now that whatever, if you think you're following a trend, which you probably shouldn't do to start with, the trend will be yesterday's news by the time your musical gets up. Just don't do it. Don't make that mistake.
When it comes to whether you're a playwright, an actor, whatever creative endeavor you're doing, there is a sense of learning from and leaning on what's been done in the past. And so obviously, as you figure out the style you want to do, how much do you refer and give homage to what's come before? And how do you know when it's time to go in a different direction?
Yeah, I think that, you know, styles change, times change. Music has changed more than anything, I think. You know, in the classic golden era of the Broadway musical, show tunes by Berner and Lowe and the Gershwins and all those people, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein most particularly, Frank Lesser, they were the creme de la creme of the pop chart. I mean, that's what people were dancing to and buying. And then when rock and roll began to take over in the 50s and essentially completely had taken over by the 70s, the music had changed dramatically. The technology changed dramatically so that you could do things on, you not only could do things on stage that were impossible 20 years earlier, but the audience demanded that you do it most of the time. And so all of that changed, and all of it will continue to change. I mean, we've learned anything, it's that it doesn't stop. You know, it isn't like, okay, so we got here. This is the destination. There is no destination. You're just on a journey. But the verities of how you tell that story, you think of it as, okay, what's the story as opposed to what's the production style or what's the kind of what's the mise-en-scène of it? Those things still seem to operate. I mean, Hamilton is written on a very classical musical theater structure, in part because Lin-Manuel Miranda was a mentee of Stephen Sondheim to some degree, and learned what a musical is. So here's a musical that's got a lot of hip hop in it. It has a few conventional, what you might call 21st century show tunes. It has a huge story to tell. It conveys a gigantic amount of information in 2 hours and 45 minutes, but still has an opening number, still has an I Want song, still has a tent pole, still, I mean, all those things are still there. And I think it's the style that evolves. And in some cases, musicals have nothing to do with any of the, as I said, any of the structural thing. But for a lot of people, they do. They still do. Particularly a lot of people who, some of whom grew up at the end of the classical era, so to speak. I mean, someone like Janine Tesori, who's a composer and lyricist who started out life playing piano in the Secret Garden, the original production of the Secret Garden, which was kind of at the end of that era. She still thinks in terms of all those things when she's writing a song.
As far as the failure of Time and Again, did that affect your willingness to do further work? Did it kind of sit with you a while as you went on to do and adapt other work?
Yeah, it was like all the other failures, you know, it's humiliating. It takes a while to digest the lessons of it. The first thing you think, I remember coming in when we did the production in New York, and my boss, Rocco Anderson, said to me, "How did it go last night?" And I said, "Show's good, the audience is bad." And he laughed so hard. And of course, what I learned from that was, no, the audience is bad, it's because the show is bad. But, you know, for a while, you just, you protest that you were misunderstood. And then you realize that you weren't misunderstood, you were understood. And that's the problem. And then you begin to think about how, okay, so I was understood. What did I do that audiences understood should not be there? And audiences don't look at these things in a technical way. They just know they're having a good time, or they're on the ride, or they're not on. And if you don't get on the ride at the beginning of the ride, you never get up. So, you know, that's why openings and I want songs are so important. So I learned that. And then, I learned other things. And then you begin to apply those things to your future work and hope that you get better. I think there probably are people who refuse to learn anything ever, but I don't think they stay in the business that long. With all due fake humility, my failures have been instructive in every case. And it's just knowing that it's going to take some time before you're willing to receive the instruction. First, you have to lick your wounds and claim that everybody else is crazy.
Thank you so much for joining Why I'll Never Make It. And don't forget, you can become a subscriber and get bonus conversations by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, that about does it for me. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. Be sure to join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.